And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
In today's episode of the Sixers Beat, Rich and I react to whatever in the ever-living heck happened Sunday afternoon in Boston in Game 7, going over how we think that will impact the Sixers' future. One quick note, we did record this, like legitimately, I think we finished recording this like 5 minutes before the news came out that Doc Rivers had been fired. So the last 15 minutes of the podcast is Rich and I going over whether or not we thought Doc Rivers would be back and whether he should be back. And I guess, sort of as a spoiler, we both thought he would be fired. After listening back to that section of the podcast, I think pretty much all of that still holds up. I think it's worth keeping in there, and we will have another podcast here on Thursday after Daryl Morey talks to the media. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome everybody. This is Derek Bodner, joined by Rich Hoffman on the Sixers Beat, part of the Athletics Podcast Network. How you doing, Rich?
Derek, I'm doing fine. Nobody else is, though.
No. And to be honest, like, that was a fucking kick in the groin. Yeah. You know, I think it was a little bit intentional to take a day or two off before we sort of had this podcast. I like to collect my thoughts on season enders like this. Also, there's just, it's not like we have to have a film breakdown of what the hell happened in Game 7, because there's no Game 8. There's no adjustments to be made. The season's fucking over. Nobody needs
a deep dive on a funeral. Series.
Yeah. But I also think it's important for us to sort of, because like, you can get swept up in the moment. Even people like us, even writers, sometimes that's fishing for clicks, which certainly does happen. Not, I don't think you or I, but you can also just get swept up emotionally in the moment and overreact to, you know, a hashtag not great third quarter that ended the Sixers season. But I think even after, you know, what's it been now? Over 36 hours, not quite 48. Even after all that time, I'm not sure that my takes or my stance has, you know, softened at all. That was a fucking embarrassment. That was incredible.
Mine really haven't changed that much either. I think I can probably put them in the proper perspective a little bit better, but the content of them have not really changed. And it's funny, a couple of years ago, I had a thing where during the Zoom era, I tweeted out a quote of Joel Embiid that was not his full quote and got absolutely ripped for that. Yep. It was for the Ben Simmons game, after the Hawks game. I got absolutely ripped for that. Yesterday, when people were fishing for clicks with his long quote about can't win 5-on-5 James Harden type stuff, I put out the full quote. I had a couple people thank me, but then I had a lot of people say, why are you putting out the full quote? That's horrible too.
Yeah. And then I had people, like when James answered about his relationship with Doc, he said, we're okay. And people were like, why are you clipping that? I'm like, no, it's actually not the clip. That's exactly what he said word for word, the entirety of it.
Look, I think our hashtag journalism was good on that. I think James was fine for one tweet and Joel was not. Like, I think Joel needed more than that, even though people didn't want to hear it. Whatever.
And Joe's answer we're getting a little off topic, but Joe's answer wasn't great even with the full context, but it was probably better than that clip suggested.
Definitely. The one CBS clip was crazy where they tweeted out the worst two sentences of it. Anyway, that is my way to get us back on topic. That is my way to point out that was a disgrace. That was a humiliating performance from top on down. And I understand why people would even say, we don't care about what the full quote was. You know what I mean? Because it was just that bad of a performance. And I get it. You know, that's my way of saying that. And look, man, I think my first take real quick here is, there have been a lot of times in Joel Embiid's career that the Sixers have lost that game. Like, it's just, they don't win game sevens. They lose. They have not in his career ever won a second round series, but I would go, I would actually get more specific than this. They have not beaten a good team in the playoffs before. All the teams they beat, they have more talent than. Like, it's these first round wins where they beat up on the kind of, you know, the cute, fun, regular season teams. When they get into a long series, when they have a series where both teams make each other look bad, as happens in kind of these slugfest long series, they are never on top. And he is the one common denominator of this. And a lot of the time, we could point and say, well, he didn't fix it, but there was another...
Yeah.
There's another fire over here. Like,
no,
look
he
at
was
that.
At
like,
the center of this one.
Yeah. And you look at... let's just even just look at the last previous two years before this year. You have Ben Simmons, just whatever. And by the way, Ben Simmons, I mean, my God, like what are you doing? From your couch making fun of the Sixers. Man, you have the worst contract in the league. Nobody wants to hear from you, man.
It might be the last playoff win of his career.
Seriously. And also, thank you for, Kendrick Perkins has gone up in my book for just completely tweeting out. It's like, well, of course he's watching the game. He's watched games all year. Like,
yeah.
Kendrick Perkins, who was lighting the Sixers up, deservedly so, also took time to say, no, Ben Simmons, you don't get to do this. That was the problem in 2021. Like, that was the main issue. Last year, and I remember the pod very well that we did, James Harden just quit on him. It was the ball didn't find me game. Like, I didn't get the ball. But look, at this point of his career, Joe has never stepped up and won one of these series.
No.
He's the MVP. He's the best player. And I think there was at least a current online, there was some discussion of, hey, like, is this guy ever going to be as good in the playoffs as he is in the regular season? Like, when is his moment going to be? Because it's never happened. Not only did he not have that moment this year, but he was at the center of it. You can't look the other way. And that's why that quote rubbed people the wrong way, is because even if he was rambling, and that's a sentiment that he kind of says a lot, like, I can't win by myself, they lost because him and James Harden, he was horrible. It was a humiliating performance. And it's something that, like, look, I know the caveats. I know he's hurt. That definitely bothered him. I know his defense was really important this series. Like, I don't think they get to game 7 without that defense. You can't do that in a game 7 when you're the MVP of the league. You just can't do that. You can't no-show. You can lose. Look, he still would have gotten a lot of crap if he lost. But after his career and the fact that he has had no great playoff moments, to look for that signature game, and that's what it was. He was looking for the signature win. He actually had a signature game in the wrong way. Like it was a signature. This guy, until further notice, is probably the biggest 82 game player in the league. And whatever he does in the future, there's going to be a big old asterisk. He's going to get a lot of skepticism because he's never done it in a game that really matters. He just never has. And that's my big takeaway.
Yeah. And to your point, like, part of his quote, right before he said that me and James can't do it alone, he said, all of us, we have to come back and find ways to keep improving and help the team. I think if he would have just ended it there, he probably wouldn't be getting the backlash, because I think that's a fair sentiment to add. We all have to get better. You don't have to then go and point out that basketball is a 5-on-5 sport when you were the one who was the biggest. I mean, they were in that game because of their role players. They were in that game because PJ Tucker went crazy in the first quarter. They were in that game, quite frankly, because Tobias Harris was at least searching out early offense and getting out in the break and trying to do something. They were in that game, you know, because they had the role players that were making plays in the first half while their two stars were MIA. That is just not the time to, you know, remind people that basketball is a 5-on-5 sport. We fucking know. You were the biggest problem, not the biggest, maybe. Well, you were at least the biggest disappointment in that game and the reason they were going home. And I mean, look, I think sometimes the numbers themselves can be overblown a little bit, in part because first round, he was playing the game that they should have played with the style that Brooklyn was playing. And, you know, there were times, like, if you would have ended this series through three quarters of game 6, like, he was putting up very good numbers, especially after getting acclimated back in game 2. Like, games 3, 4, 5, and the first three quarters of game 6 were good Joe performances. But the way that it just all fell apart so quickly, and look, you mentioned all of the qualifiers the injury, the knee, the time off, all that stuff. He came out to start that game, and he looked like absolute dog shit on the defensive side of the court. Even before we get into the offense and the struggles, and you're shooting like 2 for 8 in the first half or whatever it was,
yep.
He was not engaged. He looked like he wasn't there mentally. And it blew my, like, first play of the game, first awesome possession. He's defending Robert Williams 24 feet from the basket and going over top of the screen on the perimeter. You know, a couple of minutes later, he completely falls asleep, loses Robert Williams again. Now,
rebound.
It ended up not really mattering because Robert Williams isn't going to do anything with the ball in his hands. But you could just see with the way he reacted, he did not know where Robert Williams was on the basketball court, which is not great. He lost Al Horford really badly on a cut, with which Al ended up making that extra pass for a bucket. He was completely off balance on a Jason Tatum drive where Tatum made him look completely ridiculous on a dunk to the basket. He was not locked in at all mentally to start that game. And then he was flat-footed on defense. And this is all before we even get to his offensive problems that continually persist in this round in the playoffs. He was just not locked in. And look, did he eventually have moments where, like, his effort was good and he came back? Sure. But you can't start the game the way that he started the game in the biggest game of your career. It was very deflating. Very, very deflating.
This is not a Tuesday in February against Detroit. This is Game 7. You said after Game 6, after the horrible Game 6, you said, these are the games you dream of. These are the games when you're a kid you want to play. How about you treat it like that? What is going on? And it's, look, he's in for a rough awakening, man. That, unfortunately, he's going to have to own that for a long time. Like, he didn't sound like he wanted to own it after the game, but it's a nightmare performance. And then you mentioned the offense, right? This is the guy who scored, I don't know what he scored in that third game this year, but, you know, they were throwing the ball to him at the end of that game.
Yeah.
And he was, as Brett Brown would say, like horsing. They were horsing him. He was just getting bucket after bucket, tough physical play, drawing fouls, good fouls, making big shots. And then he goes 20 of 25 in that fourth game. It was 2018 all over again in the game that Matt, like, horrible turnovers, post-ups, like, and after the game, he's talking about, I know what I need to do to get better or whatever. What? We spent 3 years, watching you try to get those tunnel vision turnovers out of your head and play a more efficient game. And at the biggest point, they pop up again. What are we supposed to do with that?
That was exactly in my notes. This looked like a game straight out of 2018. From the, you know, trying to establish post position to struggles to get the ball to him, to bad fadeaways, to not being able to, you know, overtake Al Horford, to turnovers, to not having any kind of a real plan of attack to counter any of that. It looked exactly like a Celtics Sixers series in 2018. And for all of the work that he put in to have that face-up game, that pocket pass from James, which, credit to the Celtics, they took away very aggressively, and the Sixers never countered that, outside of hoping that their role players would make a lot of threes. It just, he got flustered and turned into his worst instincts. Like, Boston turned him into the worst version of himself.
And look, I get it. Like, Robert Williams, I think this needs to be mentioned. Robert Williams playing completely screwed the Sixers up, the two big lineup. Like, I know PJ made had that great first quarter. Look, the Sixers, what they were up, they had 29 in the first quarter because PJ was hitting his threes. So there were ways to counter that. And of course, the Sixers have their worst 2 3-point shooting games, like, in a row of the season in the two games that matter. So that's awesome. And that has nothing to do with Joel or James. Although they did contribute to some of those misses, but whatever. If he would just drive Al Horford and kick the ball to PJ every possession because Williams is at the rim, I would buy that. I'd say, okay, look, they're throwing a defensive coverage at you. These step back post ups that, like, he's not even coming close to penetrating against Horford. Not good enough, man. Just straight up not good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to your point, PJ had, you know, 11 points on, what was it, 3 for 5 shooting from three. You know what he ended up with? 11 points on 3 for 6 from three. And I don't bring that up to blame PJ Tucker at all. But, and this probably applies to Harden more than applies to anyone, because Harden had driving lane after driving lane after driving lane and never even attempted to put real scoring pressure on the rim. He was completely content to just kick it out to people in the corner, which, again, if you just take it in isolation, that's a fine play. But PJ Tucker doesn't want to carry the Sixers to victory. PJ Tucker doesn't want to be the one lifting the Sixers on their back for four quarters. He can't do what he did in the first quarter the entire game. And Boston, you know, Robert Williams never, no matter how many threes PJ Tucker made, Robert Williams never changed his coverage. He was always going to help off of that because he knows the Sixers aren't getting over the edge by PJ Tucker scoring 30 points. It's just not, at some point you need your stars to be stars. And the Celtics were so effective at making sure that James Harden and Joel Embiid were not stars. Sixers didn't have a chance. I don't even care. Like, Sixers shot 8 for 37 from 3. That's not going to win you very many games. They shoot 12 for 37. They're not winning that game because their stars were just not good enough. And James drove me. Like, even when they brought Robert Williams out, Al Horford was still overplaying that pocket pass because James Harden just had no interest in scoring at the rim. None at all. None at all.
But, you know, and look, I think James's performance was bad. I think some of those driving kicks he made were okay, though.
Everyone, almost not everyone, because he had that one where he tried to throw it to the wing and there was no Sixer in the wing, and that was
followed
that was
by Joe throwing a backcourt violation on the next possession. Yeah. That was great stuff there.
No, I think almost every one of those passes, every one of those kickouts were defensible in the moment. But at some point, you need your two stars to be able to carry an offense that's struggling. And the Sixers at no point were their two stars able to reignite an offense that was misfiring from the perimeter. Like, you need a plan B if your role players aren't able to carry you.
I think that's entirely fair. And look, I think I hold Joel to that standard more than James, but James also had nothing. But like, let's look at Joe for the entire series, though, by the way. If you look at this, James got him one game when Joe didn't even play. James got him a second game in which Joe melted down in the fourth quarter. They had one game where they both were really good, and I thought Joe was better. Okay, they had one normal game. Where's the game that Joe was great? Where's the game that he took over and they won? That's all he needed, and it's tough. He's been the best thing for this franchise over the past decade. They've made so many mistakes. One of those mistakes scored, 51 points against them, one of the biggest ones in that game. But at some point in the games that matter, like, this guy's got to play his best basketball, and he's not even close. And it's a really disappointing performance. He is getting absolutely shredded locally. Like, this is very interesting because this series starts with him getting the MVP award. Yep. It is a triumphant moment. He is probably the most popular player in the city, but I mean, you know, Jalen Hurts and Bryce Harper, whatever, but like, he's on that level. And it ends, like you said, he got absolutely shredded. So I actually don't know where it goes from here. I mean, I assume it'll get better just because
time tends to heal
some wounds, not all wounds, but some wounds, you know.
Time might heal the anger, but time isn't going to give anyone confidence. Like, I don't care. They can change a coach. We can talk about that. They can change Harden or Tobias. We can talk about that. This fan base isn't going to have any confidence in this organization until they are able to prove them wrong. And they won't have a chance to prove them wrong now for a full calendar year. It's going to be fascinating. I think the anger is probably going to, you know, slowly turn to apathy, which isn't really great for an organization. But no. Like you said, to go from winning the MVP, a triumph of skill development over a half decade, to even his supporters don't really believe in him right now. It's a wild roller coaster. It's wild.
That happened in 9 days, dude.
I know.
9 days. Not even 9 days. It's it's wild.
This is going to be such a tough conference finals because, I mean, obviously Tatum and Butler. Tatum being and look, they never had a chance to draft Jason Tatum. We don't have to really relitigate that too much. If the Sixers don't agree to not take Tatum, Boston doesn't trade out of that one pick. That being said, I talked to many people in that front office at the time. They didn't believe Jason Tatum could develop into being a top scoring option in this league. So, like, I don't want to even give them a benefit of the doubt. They had a scouting miss as well as not having the opportunity to really draft Jason Tatum. But it's really Jimmy Butler that, like, they just. There's a little bit too much similarity in Harden and Embiid when adversity hits. You need an equal to Embiid who has that kind of, you know, when the I'm trying not to go too sports takey here, but when adversity hits, they respond in a way that lifts up their team. Joe's just never done that. James has never really done that. And I'm a little worried that these two stars are a little too alike, not necessarily in game, obviously, because Joe's such a much more committed and impactful defender, but in how they react to adversity and how they, the little things. I'm really worried.
And I think we knew that about James. Although I got to say, he, as bad as Harden was in four of the games, he gave four absolute stinkers. I think he was 12 of 55 in the four games. He did his job. He got them two wins. And it's, I just look at Joe and I think, like,
no,
he's got to be the guy.
He's the one that hurts because he's the one that we believed in.
Yeah. And look, I think there is a chance. Well, one other thing on Tatum real quick. Tatum and the Celtics are just the Sixers' complete polar opposite. Because, look, Tatum, the Sixers, if Embiid and Harden showed up to play, they're probably not winning that game regardless because Tatum was spectacular. That was
He didn't even have a turnover. He had 51 points and zero turnovers.
That was just a spectacular basketball game from that dude. I think we need to point out that guy went like 0 for the world in games 3 to 6 in the first half. And in game 6, he literally was keeping the Sixers in the game for three quarters. He was horrible. And the Sixers had the chance to not give him that game 7. They had the chance to have whatever the equivalent of the Celtics beat. Is there a podcast like that? I don't know. Sure.
Whole CLNS they Media, would, they used to be our ad partners.
They would have been killing Tatum going into the offseason. The Celtics had more talent. He completely screwed the pooch. He was horrible. And the Sixers and Joel Embiid had the chance to do that on their home floor. They earned it. Like, look, James Harden gave them a couple of games, and they were terrific in Game 5 in Boston. So they earned that opportunity. And when they are presented with that opportunity, what happens? The last 6 minutes of the game, their offense is a complete nightmare at the absolute worst time. They have the ball, I think, up to with 4:30 left in the game. And after the game, you have Joel saying, I didn't get the ball. And we missed a bunch of threes and all these things. And look, that is the story of the Sixers and the Celtics. When, look, the Celtics might screw around, and they definitely probably screwed around a little bit in this series. But when the games really matter and when you have an opportunity to completely knock out a team, the Celtics do it. I think their Game 7 records spell that out. And Jason Tatum does it. And when the Sixers have a chance, they do not. And Joel Embiid does not. And that is, unfortunately, it's a really tough thing for the Sixers just to overcome. I feel bad for fans. Like when they've watched this story time and again, and you know, I saw a stat, they have the second most wins since 2017-18 in the regular season. In that span, 14 teams have made the conference finals. They are not one of them. And I get it that I think there's a chance that the Celtics beat the hell out of the Heat. I really do. I think there's a chance that was the conference finals. Not to say that the Sixers would beat the hell out of the Heat in the same exact way. It's just really tough, man. I don't know.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, this will probably. Yeah. I mean, it's weird because like you said, this might be the best team left. Although, you know, hat tip to Denver. They're really playing well. This is one of the two best teams left in the playoffs. They're one of the two best teams coming into the playoffs, I think. And the Sixers played them. Well, like through five games, really through 6 3/4 games, the Sixers were overachieving relative to expectations. And they did enough, both Harden, a little bit Embiid, because he was really good in the middle part of the series, and the role players did enough to readjust our expectations and put them in a spot where they could rip our hearts out and take away any kind of confidence we have in them. The end of the series was that bad that it's impossible to look at a 7-game loss to the Boston Celtics as a positive. When coming in, I think most of us would have said, again, that's probably overachieving what our expectations are. Yep. You just can't, like, yeah, it's, you know, game one and game two and or game one and game four might matter just as much as game 7 analytically. but you can't, like, the mentality, the mindset, there's just not enough time to course correct if something goes wrong in the third quarter of game seven. And for them, and this is why I go back to Embiid and his defense to start, because it's one thing for shots to not go in. You saw that with, you know, Celtics were playing with their lives on the line in game six, and Jason Tatum came out and was 0 for 11. But they were locked in. They were still playing defensively. It would be one thing if Embiid just came out and in game seven missed a couple of turnaround jumpers. He wasn't there to start. I can't get past that. I can't.
It's bad. And look, Harden was bad too. Like, and I think when you look at Harden, there was just no middle ground in this series. There was one game with the middle ground. He put together two absolute masterpieces. He played one really solid floor game in which the rest of the team was really good. Those were Embiid and Maxey's best games as well. And then the other four games were just,
Let me ask you, though, win. If Boston came out with this lineup to start the series, do you think, I think if Boston comes out with this lineup, the Sixers probably lose in five. They had no real answer for it. They had no answer.
I mean, sometimes you can find answers as the series goes along a little bit better, sure, in terms of feeling it out. And look, that lineup was a complete game changer, which is crazy because the regular season was the exact opposite on that front. I think the Celtics would have had a couple of games where they really struggled to score with that offense. I know they struggled to score anyway, so maybe they would have taken that in the aggregate. It's tough. I mean, look, the Sixers, their 3-point shooting in those last two games,
horrendous.
And I go back to this. As much as Joel and James were bad, all you need is a normal 3-point shooting game in game six, and you knock these suckers off.
You don't have a chance to disappoint in game seven. Yeah.
Yep. I really think game six is probably, is it more harmful than the Ben Simmons loss? I think it is, in fact. I do. Because Joel took such a big hit in game seven, and that didn't have to happen. You go from triumph and advancing and getting to the next spot to, oh my God, the most embarrassing game of your career. Yep. Here it is. Get ready for it.
Yep.
And as bad as Joe was, and as bad as James was, and as much as Doc at the initial part of that game was not really ready for that two big lineup, if Melt hits his threes in that game, they win.
Yeah.
If Tyrese hits his open, I think Tyrese was 1 of 7 on open threes. They shot 6 of 25 on wide open threes in that game. And they go out and have a similar performance in game seven. For their 3-point shooting to completely leave them in the two biggest games of the season, this is the best 3-point shooting team in the entire league. That's so Sixers it hurts. It just...
Yeah,
there's no words for that. And that has nothing to do with Joe. That has nothing to do with James. They just didn't make shots when they needed to. And that sucks.
Yeah. No, game six, I certainly agree with you there.
Yeah, I mean, game seven would have been a loss regardless, but might not have been quite as big of a loss. Game six could have won. Really could have beat him. And it's funny.
Well,
because,
and also because at least Joe was playing pretty well through three quarters of game six, too. It wasn't like he was a no-show in game six up until the last few minutes.
And I think the word you used, overachieve, is a good one, right? Because you leave this series saying, oh, yeah, the better team definitely won. Like, they had a couple of blowouts. Like, they could have won. So it's ridiculous that only the Sixers can have a series in which the gap feels as wide as it's ever been between them and the Celtics. And you can also say, oh my God, they missed an unbelievable chance to beat them.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in the NBA. That's like a football type of thing where it's a one game sample or whatever. No. They literally blew a golden opportunity to finish these guys. And yet at the end of that series, you go, oh my God, the gap between these teams is insanely wide.
No, and it's so much not the loss in seven to the best or second best team in the league. It is I have lost confidence in the person who this entire franchise is built around. It'll be interesting to see how that changes over the course of the summer, whether that gets softened a little bit. But he was just not, I can't, it blew my mind. I came out, you know, after they lose game six, you have a lot of sort of, you envision the game playing out. And I saw the game playing out a lot of different ways. I did not envision Joel Embiid coming out and just looking like he wasn't there mentally to start. And it's one thing, like, all right, maybe bad body language, maybe he presses, or maybe he gets scared of the moment after Tatum hits like a billion threes there in the second, third quarters. I could have envisioned that. The opening of that game, I didn't see it playing out that way at all. It really disappointing stuff, really. And I think as the summer goes on, you can say, all right, well, if they make enough shots in game six, then they win and triumph and beat your nemesis and advance. Mm. It's hard for me to do that given how that played. It's hard.
That is true. But at some point, teams deal with adversity, and how you handle that adversity is really important. And look, Joel after the game made a point of, you know, if I'm not winning the title, you know, am I really happy if I come in second or third or whatever? And I think that is a fair point. Like, when you lose, maybe gets a little bit overblown. Although I do understand fans just being like, can you at least get past this round? It's ridiculous that you lose in the same spot.
You said earlier is key here. It's one thing if, all right, what was it? JJ Redick, not every season ends in tears, but most of the good ones do. Something like that. That I think that's largely true because only one team is really happy about their season when all is said and done. The difference, it's not so much for me the second round that they lost in the second round again and failed to get past second round for the, you know, sixth year in a row. It's the fact that they don't have that signature win in the playoffs, that they don't have that series win over a better team, that they haven't elevated their game and beaten somebody who was favored coming in. The thing with getting to the conference finals or the finals is that you've beaten a really good, possibly great team to get there. They just haven't done it. And I think that's a great point by you because that to me is a key much more than the second round thing.
Yeah, it's tough. And I also think in this case, you know, when you lose is one thing, but how you lost is bad. You went out sorry. I get it. Okay, fine. You have the bad game six. You don't shoot well. You complain about the fouls. Whatever. You got to respond. Like losing is one thing, but losing in that fashion is another thing. And I think it's fair to point out that you can't get blown out because you don't have the energy. And Joe takes most of the brunt there. And, you know, we'll talk about Harden because I don't think he's ever going to have two playoff games in a series like that ever again. No. So. That's a tremendous wasted opportunity. But to me, unfortunately, Joe was the story here. And I want to have sympathy for him. I get it. I think he's pretty banged up playing in that series.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't defend it, though. Can't defend that performance.
If you're banged up, that like then your focus has to be even higher. Like you have to be more focused because you can't do what you normally do physically. And I don't think he was focused on that game. Now, I won't say he wasn't focused on that game because I'm sure that's what he was thinking about. But his focus was not good enough to win at the highest level and in that kind of pressure-packed environment. It was stunning.
And he's banged up every year. Like that just has not happened. He has not had a healthy playoff run. But man, at some point, just if you're that good, you got to find a way to break through. And that was a disappointing series in its own right. But I think when you also have the Sixers' history and have Joel's history, it makes it even tougher. And you know what you mentioned? I want to get one last point, I think, before maybe we get in a doc, is you mentioned the apathy. I think that is right on the money. Because, man, the lack of trust that this team has and the kind of skepticism and, I don't know, oh, here we go again, that this fan base has for this team, I noticed that in a big way during this playoff run. It's going to be multiplied by five now. It's just, they're going to have to overcome not a lot of enthusiasm about this team. And frankly, I think they've earned it.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. 100%. You like, I'm not going to sit here and say that Joe can't have a long playoff run over the course of his career.
I'm not saying that.
But he has to prove people wrong. He has to prove people to people that he can succeed in these kind of environments before they will believe that he can. And again, I think that's different than, you know, writing an epitaph on a tombstone, but he has to prove it. It's the reality of where we're at. And we can go back to various examples. You know, I think, you know, Dirk is the one that everyone's pointing to. Well, Dirk had more playoff success before.
Much more.
You have to win a series that people remember.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, let's go to Doc. There's a report from Ramona Shelburne of ESPN.
All right, let's go to Doc. Ugh.
It's like
Matt Cord. It's like Matt Cord after like a sad bucket in February.
Tatum for three.
Yeah, exactly.
Report from Ramona Shelburne, and I think Ramona is as plugged into these Sixers stars as anybody. That the decision on Doc Rivers will impact, I'm paraphrasing here, I don't have it in front of me, but basically that decision on Doc Rivers will influence James Harden's desire to come back. We talked to James after game 7, like we said, Harden's response was, our relationship is okay, which okay is like, you know, when I go to a restaurant and it disappoints me, I say, yeah, the food was okay. It means I'm never coming back. If I go to the restaurant and give a review that the food was okay, I'm never coming back to that restaurant. And for him to be so short in his response, you know, you can add that with the Ramona report. And I think it's not too tough to read in that he might not be the biggest Doc Rivers fan. We can have a discussion of whether James Harden is good enough right now to dictate a coaching position. But I think it's pretty
it's
clear
a fair one.
There might not be a lot of love there. Do you think Doc is brought back? And do you think he should be brought back?
I don't think Doc is going to be back. I don't think he should be back. But I'll add one more thing. I don't think the reason he should be back is because James Harden does not like him. Now, I understand that is going to play a factor, especially if James is brought back. But still, I am coming to the same conclusion as James Harden. And look, we could talk about Doc this series. I don't think ultimately you look at this series and say, man, Doc was a disaster.
Yeah.
He had a couple of nice wins. Game one, especially when you, like, again, like, he wins the shorthanded game. They execute a little bit better down the stretch in game 4, although I will say there was a big offensive collapse happening before that, that he also oversaw. Game 5 was, you know, just a clean, perfectly well-executed game. Didn't really solve the two big lineup. I don't know what he would have done. Like, I don't know if they had the personnel to actually overcome that. That was a... Like you said, that was a card that I'm not sure the Sixers really could overcome once Missoula finally played it. And they almost overcame it because it took them until game 6,
yeah,
down 3-2 to play.
Oh, no. If I was a Boston fan, you'd be going, what the hell? Why did it take so long? You needed James Harden to be like 2018 James Harden to beat that.
So I look at that series and I look at some of the complaints I heard over the weekend about Doc Rivers of, oh, he doesn't experiment enough in the regular season. Oh, Jaden Springer didn't play in the lineup.
Oh, Jaden Springer's not a factor in this at all.
And then I hear stuff like, oh, well, what if he went all defense? What if he switched? What if he went hyperspacing or whatever? And I'm just thinking like, yeah, like, nah, in the playoffs you win with balance. Like, I tend to think That's how it works. You have to kind of balance out offense and defense. I really don't complain too much about how Doc played. I mean, honestly, what I would have complained about with Doc is that he didn't start Niang or Melton in that game, but PJ had an amazing first quarter. So I can't even, like, what are we supposed to do? That was
the first quarter was the only time they executed offensively.
Whether or not it was the right decision, like, it clearly worked. Whatever confidence got instilled in PJ. I mean, PJ airballs the first shot, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to rip Doc a new one. And then he played really well. So even that one, I can't even get too bummed about. But I have two things on the Doc Rivers part of this. And the first one, you know, we talk a lot about in the NBA, you know, fairness. Like, should Monty Williams have gotten fired? Should Bud have gotten fired? Should Nick Nurse have gotten fired? I think Monty Williams was kind of the big one, just because he really only had a couple games with Kevin Durant, and his team was just completely thin and playing so many bad players, and Denver had been together for a long time, and the new owner fires him. But I look at Doc, and I see three chances with the new and improved Joel Embiid to get past the second round. And he's 0-3, and were any of those, like, really his fault? I think the first one was probably the worst one, right? The Atlanta one.
If you're ranking, like, villains of that Hawks series, Ben Simmons number one, Doc Rivers number two.
And then the last two,
not really his fault.
Not really his fault. But nevertheless, he is 0-3. And that is the number that Brett Brown got. Brett Brown got three chances. And that, you know, as much as I argue with people about coaching and how much it matters and Doc's importance and all of this and what he could do, I do subscribe to the idea of you only get so many chances, right? Like, that's how it works. You get a couple swings at this, and I think three is a pretty good number. And if you don't get through, then you probably do deserve to get moved on from. Like, I don't think that would be a bad move. But the other reason too, and this is even beyond the James Harden piece of this, I would also say, I think even from a PR standpoint, like, I think you kind of got to move on from him, just because so many of your fans, I don't know what the exact number is, and I don't know, I don't think organizations should be completely run by public relations, but so many of your fans completely despise this guy. And if you're trying to sell that next year is different, and if you bring back Harden, and this is like kind of the same core they have, something has to change. Like, I'm sorry, you cannot run back the same crew after you go out that sorry. And it's like we've said at all times, firing the coach is the easiest thing to do. If you eat the money, Doc said he had 2 years left. Okay, like, eat that money, Josh Harris. You know, that's what is that, 1/1000th of the Commanders? Like, eat that money to bring in a new person. And ultimately, I can't argue with that. I can't really argue with either of those things. So that is where I'm at. And I think maybe a little bit for those reasons, but also because of the James Harden piece, I do not expect Mr. Rivers to be back.
Yeah. No, look, like you, I don't necessarily think he was atrocious in either of these last two second round series, but he was pretty bad in the Hawks series. And when you have an opportunity like that and you make mistakes, you lose a little bit of the equity that you have built up where, all right, maybe the next two weren't your fault, but because you came up short in the first one, the cumulative effect of it's just time to move on. So you when you have an opportunity to accomplish something, you can't miss on that opportunity. So I'm not going to feel too guilty if he ends up being a casualty, even while acknowledging he really wasn't their biggest problem in this series. But I think the biggest reason is just, like you said at the end there, it's the easiest lever to pull. It's the one that has the least impact, least downside on the franchise. It's the one that is, you don't have to worry about salary cap implications or other teams agreeing to a trade. You can pull that lever right now if you want. And maybe it doesn't do anything. Maybe it doesn't get Joel Embiid focused in a game seven. Maybe it doesn't, you know, they talked so much about, you know, Joel Embiid getting in better shape. Well, he looked freaking gas at the end of pretty much every game here, 5, 6, and 7. Maybe it doesn't get him into, you know, Giannis level conditioning. Maybe it doesn't, you know, change any of that. But you've got to try. You've just, like you said, you can't, you could talk people into run it back when it was Jimmy Butler and, you know, all of that. You can't talk it back when you're blowing game seven like this. You're just hashtag run it back isn't going to be a thing. And that is You know, like you, I think the coaching carousel can be a little bit ridiculous at times. My stance has always been this is a players league. And if your stars come up short, then probably not a whole lot you can do. All right, well, let's try another one and see whether or not you can get through the stars and get them to reach their highest levels in the second round and in the tough playoff series. Is that fair to Doc? Maybe not, but it's just sort of life in the NBA. It's when you get to these stakes, that's what you're dealing with. That's why you get a guaranteed contract, by the way. You'll be okay.
I'm not going to cry a guy a river who's going to get paid $8 million if he decides not to coach per year. Yeah, and it's one of those things where I feel like I've defended him for a long time, but at some point, you just got to try something new. You know, you got to shake things up. So that's kind of my thought on this. And ultimately, I don't know. We're speculating, like you said, but I think I would be kind of surprised if he's back. And you know, for our sanity, if he left, like it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world because the new coach would probably get a little bit of a grace period, right?
From the fans?
Yeah, just it wouldn't be Fire Doc after every game, yeah. Right? That would take a little while. No. And
you wouldn't have Fire Nurse after everyone. Fire Monty. That might take a little while. Although, they don't really end their season on a high note anyway.
That's the other thing, too. I mean, you know, we don't have to get into who they would hire yet, but, like, there's a lot of really high-profile coaches who are out there who, you know, other teams. But here's the thing, though. All of those other high-profile coaches, I follow enough people on NBA Twitter, they all follow their teams as well. And Suns fans want nothing to do with Monty Williams. Yep. Nothing to do with that guy.
Bucks fans are ready to move on before they won that championship.
They wanted Bud out of there.
There was one Kevin Durant foot away from Bud being gone years ago.
And it's funny because like Raptors fans are tired of Nick Nurse. And now those Suns fans really want Nick Nurse. And it's just like, I mean,
that's why I call it the coaching
carousel. I think the discourse is kind of crazy. Yeah. I think the discourse is kind of crazy on this. If you're passionate about your team and you want everything to go right.
And everybody bringing up Jay Wright. Like, why the fuck would Jay Wright come in? Maybe he just really wants to coach in the NBA, but like, dude's got a good gig. He's Philadelphia royalty. I wouldn't fuck that up by coming to the NBA. Not with this team.
I just never understand why you would turn the keys over to a guy who's never coached in the NBA too. Like, to me, that's a two-way street. I think Jay Wright is unbelievable, but I don't know. Whatever. We don't have to get into Jay Wright. It's I think Doc is probably not long for Philadelphia. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. Like, I get it. That's ultimately what it was. But I do think it is fitting that his last game as a Sixers coach, the one major decision that he had to make actually worked, and Embiid and Harden were a disaster, and they had no chance to win.
Yep. The only thing I will say about Doc and all this is pretty much the same thing I said when Brett Brown was let go. Just don't expect this to be a magic fix. Like, it's not going to just instantly flip your franchise and take away all their problems. That's unlikely to be true.
I'll add another one, too. You're going to, you know, if you hated Doc Rivers and Brett Brown, guess what? You're going to hate the next guy too. Yeah. I guarantee you.
Yep.
You're going to hate that person. That person is not going to do enough things. So that's all I'm saying. It's not a magic fix, but I think it's a worthwhile one.
I think you brought this up. There's only one coach in the league who's really a magic fix, and he is coaching in the next round. And Spo is not going to be available.
He's not available to anybody. Yes. Spo is the one guy where I think, okay, that's the guy who really elevates his team as a coach.
Really didn't want to have, I expected them to lose in the second round. I did not expect to have this podcast. I did not expect to be this despondent. Remember how positive, like, I don't want to say positive because we're talking like 30 to 40% chance they win, but relatively optimistic we were heading into game 7. Boy, we're fucking idiots. Don't listen to anything we have to say. Oof.
Don't listen to that game 6 pod where I thought these guys were different. And I think we did a good job today too. Just not, I mean, like we really did. They made us sound like complete dumbasses.
Complete morons.
And like, it's like, you know, I'm not, I've sounded like a dumbass before, but I think we weren't over the top in our criticism just because they made us sound like dumbasses, but they certainly did. So great.
Well, once again, it was a pleasure podcasting with you. I think we're going on a decade now. Because right, we were podcasting together at the time they drafted Embiid, and that will be a decade next year. We probably started sometime in 2013. So our 10-year podcast anniversary is coming up sometime. I don't know exactly when, but sometime. Once again, it was a pleasure talking Sixers basketball with you. I look forward to doing it in the future, and take care. I say take care. Like, we're going to podcast later this week. It's not like you're going anywhere, but, like, you know, it was fun. It was fun.
And also, shout out to our tens of listeners. Thank you for continuing to listen to us.
And subscribers. You know, we both write for subscription outlets. Thank you again. You literally make our jobs possible.
So thank you. And I guess we're sorry that your team doesn't love you.
I'm sorry they put you through this. I really am.
Look, we just cover them, but it's... I think being a fan of this team, and I'm laughing nervously, but I'm really not. I'm laughing because I feel so bad for everybody. It's just being a fan of this specific iteration and all the times they've messed up and all the times they've disappointed you and all the times they've come up small and none of the times that the opposite of those things are true is, it has to be really hard. So, I just give everybody a collective hang in there.
Yeah.
We love you.
Maybe it's not about the championship. Maybe it's about the journey. I don't know. Thank you, Rich, for jumping on, and we will talk to you soon.
See you, man.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.